Thanks a lot. It's really nice to have the opportunity to share my work with everybody, and I've been really enjoying the conference so far. I'm going to tell you about some work that I've been doing. Basically, my background is in many-body quantum physics, and a tool that I use regularly in my work are tensor networks. I'm going to tell you guys a bit about what those are, but just quickly, they're like a classical computing simulation technique to simulate quantum systems with lots of particles. I mean, out of curiosity, how many people have heard of tensor networks, like matrix product states? And okay, great. So everyone has like a familiarity. I'll do a little bit of review, though. And this was work done with David Schwab, who I owe a lot of gratitude for teaching me so much about machine learning. So I'm really learning a ton from him, and it's been really fun. Supported by both PI for part of this work and UCI and the Simons Foundation, which is supporting a lot of the work I do on the software side, too. So just to summarize the talk in one slide, like take-home message would be that tensor networks have had a really good track record of success for performing classical simulations. So I just mean, you know, we're already doing the simulations, like you don't need quantum hardware, but of quantum many-body systems. But they're really like a very general tool to compress large tensors. And if you think of them that way, but possibly with the physics intuition in the back of your mind, then they can be used to train machine learning models that formally have exponentially many parameters. So the model could be this really, really flexible large model, but the tensor network can help you hone in on the relevant parameters, and then implicitly, you know, you have these like hidden parameters in the tensor network that parameterize formally all these other exponentially many model parameters. And you know, I thought of this based on just thinking, how would I use a tensor network in machine learning? I'll blame Roger Melko and Juan for here, who gave the tutorial yesterday, for kind of getting me into this field. And I was just thinking, how would I use my tools in this field? And it turns out that the kind of thing I came up with just happened to be related to this area called nonlinear kernel learning, but there's some slight differences that I'll try to point out at the end. And there's a lot of benefits that I'm starting to see from putting in a tensor network, but the most interesting one so far is that these nonlinear kernel learning models, which there's a tutorial about those too this afternoon, so you'll hear more. But they, if you just do them the naive way, they scale quadratically in the number of training samples that you're training over, and that's not so good, because that, you know, you've heard this term big data, that could be a really big number. Whereas if you use a tensor network, that cost is only linear, so that's a huge improvement. And also, some other interesting things include that instead of the weights of the model being hidden, you can actually see them, and you can see that they adapt to the structure of the data set. So certain weights in them will just sort of drop out of the model if they're not needed, for instance. And finally, there's many opportunities that I'm still trying to realize about understanding what it is the model has learned at the end. I think there's a lot of room to improve there in this work. So what is a tensor network? So I'm going to explain this notation a bit more in the following slides, but for now, I'll just take it as a cartoon of a large tensor. So on the left, there's a large tensor T, and it has, in this case, 6 indices, but you should think of that number of indices as growing to some pretty big number, n, where n could be in the hundreds or something. So then if you think about it, the number of components of this tensor is exponentially big in the number of these indices. So that's just way too many components to even store, much less work with and do anything with. So a strategy you can use, it's sort of like an extension of the singular value decomposition, but a vast generalization of it, is to represent that tensor approximately as the contraction of many other smaller tensors. And the goal is that, or the key element here, is that you want these smaller tensors to have a number of indices that's only somewhere between 1 and 10 or something like that. You don't want these tensors to have too many indices. Otherwise, you just have the same problem that you have over here, which is you have exponentially many parameters you have to deal with. So people in applied math call this side the curse of dimensionality. I think we would call it just the quantum many-body problem. And over here, you know, basically, it's just, you know, it's like the problem of doing ED over here. Over here, we have tricks to get around it. And we would say in physics that, you know, maybe there's some low entanglement of this thing that looks like a wave function to us that allows this approximation to be good. Okay, so let me explain what these diagrams are. We got some comments from some referees that I thought I should have realized that there's similar diagrams to this you see in like neural net literature, and they're much more schematic in machine learning. So I want to emphasize that these diagrams, they look similar, like little circles, but in tensor networks, they have a completely rigorous meaning. So when I see these, I already know exactly what code I would write and run. They're just sums that I know how to do. So So what these mean is that if there's a blob, that's just like, and again, when I say tensor, some of you may think of things like GR, and there's all this geometric interpretation. I'm not meaning anything that fancy. I just mean that these are just collections of numbers indexed by different amounts of indices. So this is a vector. It's just a set of numbers indexed by some single index, a matrix, two indices, some general order three tensor with three indices. And now one nice thing about it is when you have these lines, the letters become less and less important. You don't need to actually name everything. So you get away from this problem of having to come up with names for everything. So the other main rule of these diagrams is that when you connect two lines, it means there's a sum. So it's sort of motivated by Einstein summation, where you don't want to write sigmas everywhere. Similarly, you don't have to put a sigma. You just make the lines touch. And then, you know, I kind of think of some like electricity flowing along the line, and there's like a sum happening. And then those two blobs merge together. So in this case, it's just, I would see this and say, OK, that's a matrix. That's a vector. It's a matrix vector product. And the nice thing is that graphically you can see exactly what the outcome of this will be, because you can say how many external legs are there in this diagram, and there's one. So you can see that the result of this operation is a vector at the end. A little harder over here. You have to kind of stare at it and say, oh, okay, there's I. You know, here it just is much more natural. So to make this a bit interactive, what is this diagram showing in terms of classical linear algebra language? Can anybody say, who doesn't do tensor networks? What is that called, that thing? Matrix multiplication. And then what is this one? Trace of the product of two matrices. Great. OK. So I think everyone has it. I won't spend much more time. Now there's sort of many types of tensor networks. And in the rest of this talk, I'll only really use this one called the matrix product state. I should mention, for those of you reading the machine learning literature, you'll see another term called tensor train, which actually I think is kind of a nicer name. But it's the same thing. Okay, so this is just something that has been adapted into the language of applied mathematics, and that's been very valuable for the machine learning community to have things written more into the language they understand. So I think that's really nice. And there's been some really excellent ideas coming out of that community about how to think more broadly about what matrix product states could be used to do, not just in the context of physics. So a matrix product state is just the idea is that if you took one of the elements of this tensor, like if I set each of these lines to a fixed value, then you know I set the lines over here, and then now these lines you can think of as being erased or absorbed into these blobs. And then all that's left is a chain of matrix multiplies. So it's just a 1 by m matrix, and then a bunch of m by m matrices, and then you know an m by 1 at the end. And so the idea is that, you know, multiplying matrices is efficient and can be done without any kind of blow up of cost. So the main approximation, the main like hyperparameter or control parameter here is the bond dimension called M in the DMRG literature. Sometimes it's called capital D or chi in other literature. And that's the thing that's like basically how much resources are we willing to spend to approximate this tensor. And we hope that we don't have to spend too much. And the big win here is that you have a tensor that has inside of it little d to the n parameter. So little d is the typical size, or say they're all the same size of these indices. And there'd be little d to the n is the number of indices here, parameters. And instead, you represent it only by something linear in the number of these indices times little d times m squared, which is like how many entries are in these matrices. Okay, so that's just something you can try. And it works quite well, especially for one-dimensional systems, as you might guess, because it looks kind of like a little one-dimensional train. But then without going much into it, I'm not going to use these anymore in the rest of the talk. I just want to mention that the physics community, and this is kind of the quantum-inspired slide of the talk in a big way, the physics community has done a ton of work for decades going back, and much of it actually by Giffre Vidal, who's here, who's been a big mover of both of these ideas. So go bother him if you have questions about that. He'll answer them for you. But these are both very neat things that I wish I had time to go into but can't, which are other very successful generalizations of matrix product states. So what these are, Samira is basically one that is similar to some of the ideas that David just talked about, where there's layers, and each layer has these like hidden degrees of freedom that parameterize visible degrees of freedom and can capture critical systems with critical correlations. And there's also this one called PEPS, that is motivated by some analogy of like hidden entanglement between pairs of little objects. And the idea is that this might be better at capturing two-dimensional quantum systems compared to a matrix product state, which is only really ultimately suitable for sort of quasi 1D quantum systems. Okay, so this, it'd be very neat to think about if these, if MPS, so basically one thing in my talk is I'm gonna use MPS, but for 2D data. And you might ask, why is that a good idea? Well, it was a good idea for me because MPS are easier to work with than these. And then also the point being that if MPS do succeed, then sort of, you know, how much better might say PEPs be for 2D data? So it's sort of to try the dumbest thing I can do, and if that works, then maybe an even smarter thing could work much, much better. And finally, just a little bit of physics background to say that I want you to realize that these aren't just kind of some new kind of ad hoc ideas, but these are ideas with a ton of power, and they've really led to some huge developments in the field of condensed matter physics and some other fields too. And the most important historical thing is that matrix product states, it was quickly realized, are the key idea underpinning the powerful DMRG method, which is a solver for one-dimensional systems, but which works surprisingly well for 2D systems. Like right now, it's one of the leading methods for 2D systems still. So that was very powerful. This is a little movie of a parallel DMRG calculation. I just thought it was neat. So this is actually another idea example from physics that could be adapted over to machine learning if MPS turn out to be useful, which is that you can actually parallelize DMRG calculations across a few machines. And each of these little lines is a different walker on a different, completely separate machine. And you see that after four sweeps, which is four passes over the system, it's getting exponentially converging accuracy to some ground state energy of some quantum mini-body problem. Other really nice things about tensor networks is they give a ton of insight. So it's numerics, but it's not just black box numerics. It's like you can look into the numerics afterward and you can learn a ton about what the system is actually like. And you know, they've even been used even in a non-numerical context for, say, classifying exotic phases of matter. So for understanding what are all the different kinds of topological phases in certain dimensions and things. And then there's a really vibrant ongoing field of developing powerful numerics based on these techniques. And that's something that's happening a lot here at PI, actually. So now, right into the proposal for learning. So how would we adapt these ideas for learning? And by the way, I should also mention, I should have had a slide, but there is a lot of prior work on using things like MPS or tensor trains in machine learning. But what I wanted to do a little differently is those prior works often say, let's take a set machine learning approach, something like neural networks, and let's take a piece of it that maybe we can put a tensor network in. I wanted this approach to be more sort of based around the tensor network itself and see, you know, kind of let's like try to draw out the most power out of the tensor network that we could. So I thought that would be pretty interesting. So to do that, I wanted to mimic the context that we use tensor networks in physics, and that context is quantum state space, right? So it's working with exponentially large vectors that live in Hilbert space. So how do we go from data which lives in some kind of like linear size space, like these X's could be anything, but they could say be numbers between, you know, 0 and 1 that represent grayscale pixel values, and there maybe there's hundreds of them, but 100 is not that big a number. You know, how can we go from this sort of moderate size space to this, you know, vastly bigger exponential space? And the way you do that is just take a big tensor product. So the idea is that you take these raw inputs, x, the x's, and then you have a little mapping where you have a certain number of these functions, you know, little phi 1 through little phi d. Here I'm just saying d equals 2. And then you take a big tensor product of them all together. That's not totally a new idea. You can find work going back on these things called ANOVA kernels in kernel learning, where this sort of feature map was proposed. But you know, this kind of takes on a new life when you actually parameterize the weights as a tensor network. And I'll tell you what some of those things are in a bit. Now, using this tensor notation, how does this look? So I take this x vector, which is large but not so big, and again, I plug it into all these little vectors of functions, and then I get this big tensor product. So again, one nice thing about tensor network notation is that you don't have to put this circle. Simply just putting tensors near each other implies an outer product or like a tensor product. Now, one choice is that I'll make in the experiment I'll show you is that I demand that these vectors of these phis are normalized. Now, that's something I'm kind of considering relaxing, because as we'll see, there's some nice insights you can get using a different map, which happens not to be normalized. So that's something I'm debating about how important that is, but I'd like to hear any feedback you have. And then you can see that just by kind of counting that this phi maps an n-dimensional space to a d to the n-dimensional space. But of course, there's something very special about this particular vector in this d-dimensional space. It has a rank of 1. It's a very low rank. In the language of physics, it's a product state. Okay, so that's just a choice. We could be mapping to entangled states if there's a reason to do that. But here, I'll just map to a product state. And then just to give you a very concrete example of one of these local feature maps, I'm calling them, then this is the one I'll use for this image classification. It's this choice that's sort of motivated by a spin a half. just kind of in a cute, you know, kind of a cute way, that you map from a white pixel maps to a vector 1 comma 0, and a black pixel maps to a vector 0 comma 1, and then crucially, if it's gray, it maps to some like superposition of white and black, say, if you want to use a quantum analogy, or in more plain language, it's just some vector that's both has some overlap with white and black. And that's important because we're going to use the idea of dot products or overlaps of these things to give some kind of notion of distance in this space. And if everything was orthogonal to everything else, it'd be really hard to identify clusters or do any kind of, so we need to have some notion of distance. So we don't want we don't want to just binarize this into black and white. We want to have some grayscale in there. That seems to be very important. And finally, what does the model look like? Well, the whole goal all along is to take the data and represent it in this big tensor product so that the weight parameters here, that I'm calling W, would look like the kind of thing that we know how to decompose using tensor networks, would have n indices all of some smallish size. And that's the model. And some of you may recognize this as being the kind of models that you get in kernel learning methods, support vector machines, that kind of thing. So there's that's where the similarity comes in. But then the philosophy here is very, very different, because then they often will they'll often solve this model in a very different strategy. Here I'm going to use the strategy of actually working directly with the weights, but with an approximation. Just again, in traditional notation, this just kind of looks like some decomposition of a function in some basis along all the different directions, and then the W is just the coefficients of this decomposition. That's all it is. Okay, and so then now specifically, I'm going to choose the following tensor network, which is the MPS. And so when you choose the MPS, then this big weight tensor, which you could never even store, you can never even fit it into a computer, much less optimize, now everything becomes tractable. So now we just represent it as a matrix product state. Okay, and then finally, I'm going to use it to identify handwritten digits. This is this famous MNIST handwritten digit set. And so I need a way to have multiple labels so I can identify various digit types. And this kind of bothers some people, and I understand why, that, okay, of course, here it's sensible to just have a bunch of different functions and stick the label onto the weight. But then what I did is I decided, when I make the MPS decomposition, I'll arbitrarily stick this label onto just one of the MPS tensors. And now MPSs have a huge sort of amount of gauge degrees of freedom where you can merge two of these tensors together and then do an SVD to pop them back apart. And in the process of doing that, you can move this label around. So you can actually let it kind of dance around and move around over all these different tensors. And in the end, what's kind of neat about this, and this is already something that's a little bit perhaps beyond things that are discussed in kernel learning, is that you have a sharing of features here in a sense. So you have one guy whose job is to distinguish classes, and then these guys' job is not to do that. It's simply to gather information and kind of pass that to this guy. So you have sort of a hybrid of things that are doing something a bit more unsupervised-ish, where they're just looking at the data, than this one, which is actually discriminating between different classes. But another choice would be not to have this label and simply just to have a collection of these different W's that are all completely different MPS. And that would work too, and that might work even better, and I'm experimenting with that. But I think it's interesting that it does actually work where they can mostly share the same wings, if you will, and then there's just this core that is different among the different functions. And then the way we choose the label is I take in input data, which will be vectors of pixel values, and then I just look at, for a particular image, which function gives the biggest overlap. And then that's the one, that label will be the one I pick for that image. Josh. Yeah, this is something that I'm pondering is like, can we apply probability interpretations to all this? Like, are these wave functions in a sense? But I don't want to I don't want to commit to saying that, because that may have some problems. But I think it's something interesting to pursue, Okay, so here's the experiment. So we'll take this pretty famous, nice data set called MNIST. And it's a collection of grayscale handwritten digits. They're 28 by 28 pixels. This is a bunch of them. And you get 60,000 training images to train over, and then you have to test your model on 10,000 labeled test images. So this is just supervised learning, because the word labeled appears here. And so we just take all these in, and then we want to be able to distinguish fours from fives from sixes and so on. So one little detail is that it was just helpful to shrink the images down a bit, because I'm using matrix product states, which really aren't very suitable for 2D. It was nicer to have a smaller size. And actually, that's fine, because that should actually make learning harder, because I'm throwing away information. I just did this shrinking in some really naive way. Then the other thing we do, and this should look a bit awkward, and it is, because you'd really want to use some 2D tensor network, here we're using a 1D tensor network, is that we order the pixels in this kind of zigzag pattern. So we basically, 1 through 14, then 15 starts here and here. So there's these kind of jumps where the tensors connect in this funny zigzaggy way. But that's something we do to do 2D quantum physics, and it works surprisingly well, basically just because MPS are just so powerful that they can even overcome these kinds of difficulties. And then we use a DMRG style algorithm, meaning where we kind of leave most of the tensors fixed, and then there's only the one that has the label on it, or maybe the one next to it. We let those vary, and then we hold the rest fixed. And in mathematics, that's just called alternating least squares, where you hold many numbers fixed, and you just vary a few, and then you kind of move along, varying them in little local patches. This idea is also called DMRG in the context of physics. So a bit more about what is the optimization. So you can choose many different cost functions. This one just had some technical mathematical advantages, and it's a common one, which is just to say, how well does our actual output on some of the training images, xn, compared to the desired output? And so the desired output here is defined just to be one, if the label stuck on f is the label that's the actual label of xn, and then zero if it's the wrong label for xn. So that's all this is saying. And so we just want f to be close to one if it's the right label, and then zero otherwise. And then that's the guide that we optimize. So we basically sweep along, meaning hold most of the tensors fixed, and then kind of open up the insides of the tensor that has the label on it, and absorb one more next to it, and then do gradient descent just on those parameters, leaving all the other parameters in the network fixed. Get some improvement, but we're not globally optimizing, we're just optimizing over those tensors. Then we move along and just keep doing this in little local patches and go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And importantly, the training time scales only linearly in the size of the training set. Every time we compute a contribution to the gradient, here I just did the full gradient, one could imagine doing the stochastic gradient also. But here, even with the full gradient, at every point in the algorithm, we're just directly talking to the weights. We're not having to work with this, if you know about kernel methods, we're not having to work with this nt squared by, or nt by nt big kernel overlap matrix. That doesn't come in. We just directly take each training image, and for each one, we push the, it gives a little contribution to how we should push that core tensor along. And then we just take that better core tensor, we break it back apart into so it fits into the MPS approximation, and then we just slide along and keep improving. So that's pretty exciting, because there's a lot of methods in the literature for taking these family of kernel methods and making them have this linear scaling, but they rely on all kinds of other assumptions about the data, which perhaps this one is relying on too, and that will require more work. But this is using a very different approximation where we directly approximate the weights, and that's pretty interesting. And again, there's other kinds of tensor networks than MPS, so we can try to bring down these additional costs. You're sort of trading this n squared cost for some other cost of how many hidden variables you're working with cubed here. But other tensor networks have different costs and may be more efficient for various types of data. So finally, how well does it work? This is a pretty exciting thing, is that already for an extremely modest bond dimension of 10, when we transfer our model over to the test set, we only get 500 out of 10,000 of the images incorrect. That's pretty cool. And then when you do 20, which is again very tiny for in the physics context. Normally we'll keep hundreds and thousands for M. Already it drops to 2%, so this is already approaching pretty state of the art. And finally, when we really push on it and make the bond dimension 120, we get only 97 images out of the 10,000 test images wrong. So we get above 99%, and that's pretty great. So let me show you just a little demo of this. So here's just a little kind of web page I cobbled together where you can doodle some kind of image that the classifier's never seen before, and fingers crossed, okay, it gets it. So that's pretty cool. And you see it's very error tolerant. Okay. So it expects them to be centered and scaled correctly. So let's see if it finds that one. Great. Okay, and then we can I handed this to Giffrey one time in the bistro, and he tried to mess it up, so he was trying to do this, and let's see what it says about this. So, what is that? let's see if it can outsmart us. Okay, I promise I did not pre-program that. Okay, so just to prove to you that I didn't pre-program this, let's really try to mess it up. Let's give it something crazy, and it should fail. I think this is a one. So I promise I didn't have that pre-scripted, right? But we can give it an actual one, and we can see that that it'll do it. Okay. Great. So, you know, it can do all the digits 0 through 9, so it's pretty fun. And if some of you want the link, I can give that to you offline. I don't want too many people hitting our poor little server at Irvine. It's just a little desktop server, so I don't want to overload it. Okay, so with my remaining time, let me try to give some insight into what these models are and how they might be working and what are some exciting things about them other than just that I was able to get some result on some pretty well-studied data set. Okay, so one pretty exciting thing about it already is that the tensor network approach is adaptive. And what do I mean is that, you know, I say, I'm willing to have an MPS where any of the bonds can grow as needed. They could be as big as they need. Like, maybe I'll give it a lot of resources. I'll say all the bonds can be as big as, you know, 500 states on each bond, meaning these indices can be really big. And then what I find is as I feed in the data and train, in the case of this MNIST, there are these boundary pixels at the beginning where I'm going along, kind of starting in one of the corners and going along, say, the first column or the first row, where there's a bunch of pixels that are always white. They're always white for every single image in the training set. Actually, it's not even so important that they're white, it's just that they're always the same. So there's no information there intuitively for learning, for discriminating these images. And sure enough, when I do the training and I merge some of these tensors together, I optimize them, and then I break them back apart with the SVD and look at the spectrum of singular values when you cut the MPS along various bonds, there's just a singular value and the rest are zero. So what it tells me is that these tensors just factorized out of the parameters. So what it's saying is that I'm finding out that, you know, these parameters just aren't doing anything useful for learning, and that's great. So you can imagine, I mean, this is a little silly example, but you can imagine dropping them out after a while and saying, like, we've been getting a lot of data and we've been finding that these pixels can just be ignored. They don't contribute anything, and then we could, you know, just get not look at them anymore, say. And that's kind of neat. And this is a silly example, but I think there could be much more interesting examples where you do a much more careful study of how much, using a tensor network, how much each piece of the data is really contributing to learning. Now let's kind of dive into one of these functions and see what is inside of it. So I was using this particular local feature map, cosine and sine. It was motivated kind of by some physics intuition. But there's a paper that came out right around the same time as ours that was looking at the same class of models, actually. And they chose a slightly different one, but I think theirs has some neat takeaways from it. And as you can see, it's almost the same as ours in the sense that if I take x to be small, cosine becomes 1, sine becomes proportional to x. I'm not going to worry about the pi over 2. Let's just replace it by 1 and x. This is just a motivation to see what the models do. And then if we expand, you know, so now this capital phi is going to be a product of 1 comma x vectors for x1, for x2, and so on and so on. And then if we expand and kind of group the terms in the model, so we just write out the whole sum that the model that defines the model, we see that if all the indices of the weights are in setting 1, that's a constant. So the model already builds in a constant. Then if one of the indices flips to 2, then that means that the model has a term in it that cares about a single x somewhere. So there's a 2 here or 2 here. It cares about x1, x2, x3. So there's a piece that's like a linear classifier, like just a dot product of numbers with the x's. Then there's a piece where if we flip 2 spins down or flip, you know, 2 of the indices from 1 to 2, we get x1, x2, x1, x3, all the different pairs, but not you know, ever x1 squared or x2 squared and so on. And finally, there's a parameter which is all the indices set to 2, and we get the product of all the x's. So that's kind of neat. So the idea is that when we're training the model, we don't tell it, you know, which of these w's should be 0 or non-zero. It'll figure that out on its own. So it's kind of figuring out maybe what's important for learning is pair information about pairs of x's, or maybe what's important for learning is looking at them all, or maybe a linear classifier is sufficient. You know, so the model can just determine that on its own. And just to see an extreme limit, what if we, you know, take the MPS approximation all the way to the extreme limit and all these indices which you need to be big to restore the original tensor, what if we just set them all to 1 in size and so now it just factorizes? What is that saying? Well, it's saying that, you know, we basically our function is just a product of little local functions, and so they take some kind of vote where each one looks at its local feature and then they get a number and then you take the product of those numbers and that's some kind of vote that they all take, but they don't worry about correlating information with each other. And you see that then the amplitude, so to speak, or the weights, the coefficients, are just made out of little products of the local ones. And so there's kind of no additional structure at the level of products of these x's that wasn't already there at just the levels of individual x's. And then there's kind of an interesting interpretation tied to physics here, which is that if you let this local feature map include powers of x up to some maximum power p, which I'm, you know, I should have written, but let's imagine there's a maximum here. And then you attach a fictitious particle quantum number to that locally. So if the local vector is in the state x, we think there's a particle there. And if it's x squared, we think there's two particles on that site, just fictitiously. Then if you imagine constraining the w's to have a fixed particle number, so this would be like a quantum, you know, quantum state where you have particles that are in a closed system and they can't escape, and you put one particle in the system and let it move around, or two particles and let them move around, and you look at the amplitudes for that kind of system. The one particle case is a linear classifier. It's just a vector of weights dotted with the x's just by themselves. And then the two particle system is this thing that, if you know about it, called the homogeneous polynomial kernel of order 2. And I don't have time to go into the whole theory of kernels, that'll be this afternoon, but let's just define it by this line. So it's just saying it's a function that includes all products of x's of order 2. So it could either be a single x squared, or it could be two of the two different x's. But the point is that it's just always two x's, whether it's the same x or two different x's, and that's it. And then similarly, if you have three particles, that's this homogeneous polynomial kernel of order 3, and so on and so on. So it's kind of neat, because these are actually models that people take. So people in machine learning will try, they'll say, okay, here's some data, let's guess that a polynomial kernel of order 3 is sufficient, and they'll try it, and then they'll see how it does, and then they'll try this one and see how that does. But here, the model is just free to kind of, by sort of adjusting the number of particles in the system automatically, it's free to try all these different kernels in like a virtual way, and then decide, okay, we need correlations of order 3 are important for learning, and it can just figure that on its own without us having to tell it to do that. So that's neat. And then, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but I'll just show a slide on it, that you can do, I don't want to go into the technicalities, but you can do a gauge transformation where you can actually always choose these matrices that are colored here as yellow and purple to be like isometric projections. So they're kind of like unitary in the sense that you get an identity if you multiply them in one order and a projection if you multiply them in the other order. And if you make that choice, you can always make that choice, and you can kind of view these as defining a basis for the Hilbert space spanned by just these three sites. And this is a basis for the Hilbert space over these three sites. And you're taking the data and you're saying, how much overlap does it have with different elements in this basis? So there's some basis that spans a region of kind of feature space. Then after that information's been collected, there's a central tensor which collects all that information about how much the data hits different basis vectors spanning feature space or partial feature space, and then it makes a decision about what labels should we ascribe to this thing. And now this is the MPS case. You can imagine that even more interesting stories might be told about other kinds of tensor networks. I was a little disappointed. I was hoping to actually try to study what features these wings are seeing and what they care about. But with this little local d equals 2 feature map, things are a little blurry. So maybe one needs to have larger little d to sort of resolve more details about each x. So that's some ongoing work I'm trying. I'll say a bit more about that right now, actually. So finally, one other interesting thing about these tensor networks is that it's a different kind of regularization than you might do on these kernel methods. So one, the normal type of regularization on these kernel methods, by which I just mean models of the same family I'm telling you about, is that you would take this entire W and you would just say, let's constrain its norm not to be too big. Like maybe just this W squared has to be less than or equal to 1, or we want to penalize it if it's not, that kind of thing. So it's just this kind of global regularization. Here, the regularization is rather different. It's that, first of all, we regularize in one way, which is a little less interesting, but I'll go into it, about by just choosing the local dimension here, d, not to be too big. That basically amounts to saying how rich of a function can we put along each axis x1 through xn. Like how many details about each individual xn are important for learning, which for most data shouldn't be too important. Like if you can imagine an image, it doesn't matter if I take one pixel and wiggle it in the image, it should still look like a 7 or an 8. So that we regularize that away by keeping d small. And then the other one that's pretty interesting is this bond dimension m. So at a very simple level, keeping these bounded and small just limits the number of parameters in the model. So that's regularization in the most basic sense, that the model just doesn't have enough representational power to overfit. But there might be some more interesting ways to think about it. So first of all, let me discuss this local d a bit more. So we did some experiments and some toy 2D data. I should have written out better what the model is here, but all there is there's just x1 and x2. So the inputs are just little two component vectors, x1, x2. And then I map each of them through this local feature map phi, you know, with some d, where d tells you basically you have powers of x from 0 all the way up to d minus 1. And then the model actually only has two indices, so forget all these others. The model just looks like the first two indices here, and then there's some weight tensor. And then just wanted to see what the effect of the D is. So if you take this data, which is this spirally distribution, so imagine there's two classes. One is the red class and one is the blue class. And we draw points in the blue class from the blue region, red class in the red region. And then so you can see there's a lot of information just in the two X's themselves. If we only let them use 1 and x as the basis for making functions, then obviously you can't make very complicated functions. So you just, you try, you know, the best you can to divide these two classes from each other, but you don't have a lot of representational power, so you can't. You try now allowing powers up to 3, so d equals 4, and, you know, something is starting to happen, but it's still not doing a very good job. Finally, when you give it enough of these powers of x along x1 and x2, then you can fit a pretty complicated function, and then you can actually get back the spiral, which was the hidden distribution we drew the data from. So that's kind of neat to see. So that's just an intuition about why did I take a spin a half, so to speak, in that grayscale experiment. It's because the space of each pixel in that grayscale data set does not look like this. It's much more like this. So it's much more important about whether each pixel is sort of dark or light, but we don't care. It's not like as you take each pixel and sort of bring it from white to black that the image goes from being a 3 to a 7 to a 9. It's just going to still be a 3 the whole time, pretty much. So that's the idea there. And now an interesting one that I just was thinking about recently, and it was motivated by this paper, which was talking about some models in sort of a similar family, but there's no tensor networks in this paper, but still it's interesting to look at, is that there's something maybe possibly interesting about this tensor network approximation that goes outside of the regime of traditional kernel learning. So in kernel learning, there's this thing called the dual representation where you say, and in physics language, what you say is that if we found the optimal weight tensor, you could show that it's sort of a superposition of the data wave functions in physics language. So if all those little wave functions they made out of the images or out of the data, it turns out that the optimal weights are just some kind of funny superposition of all those. In other words, basically, you have all these feature vectors in this high-dimensional feature space, and then W lives in the span of those. So that means that that in some sense that these kernel learning methods are an interpolation method. You just have a lot of data, and you're trying to make a fit inside of where the span of this data goes, and you're just trying to find somewhere that interpolates in the data. And that's called the representer theorem, and it can be proven quite generally for many, many different cost functions and regularization schemes. Now, the tensor network approximation, interestingly, can violate this condition. So you can have cases where once you take the optimal W and approximate it as a tensor network, it'll have components that are outside the span of the training data. So it can sort of stick out directions that go outside of this region and feature space where the training data lives. And so that could be, that could have interesting consequences for generalization. So it could be roughly analogous to like the thing that Cyril was showing us earlier today, where you have a table of data with missing entries, and then you take a low rank approximation, which MPS is a complicated type of low rank approximation, and it could like fill in those missing entries in the table in some sense. So that's kind of like sticking out directions that are outside of the data that we showed to the model. I think that's pretty exciting. So finally, just a bit more future directions, things I didn't have time for. As Josh kind of wanted to do, and I'd like to do, it would be really neat to be able to interpret these models as probability densities, so square the wave function, and is that a probability? Now, that's a bit independent of whether or not you parameterize it by a tensor network, but it might be kind of motivated by it, or it might be at least very useful. If we can say that that's a useful way to talk about these models, then one really nice takeaway would be that all this work that's been done in physics, thinking about entanglement, all these other nice ideas, sampling from matrix product states, thinking of their square as defining a probability, all those techniques and all those ideas could be directly imported from physics. But right now, only a more limited set of techniques can be imported if you're being conservative about things and not taking this interpretation. A very crucial question is, for which sets of data can I get away with a matrix product state with a small bond dimension? And in some sense, you know, for which sets of data is W like low entanglement, so to speak? In which, you know, which cases do the parameters of a model have an efficient tensor network approximation? And this is very off the cuff, but I wondered if this could have implications for quantum algorithms. Say you wanted to use quantum hardware to pull off one of these kernel learning classifiers, W.phi, maybe you need to know something about that this W is in like a physically accessible region of Hilbert space that has something to do with a finite depth quantum circuit. therefore, you know, making the entanglement sort of reasonable in order to use quantum hardware. So that's just a thought. So maybe these ideas have some links. And then very important and kind of neat, fun question would be, you know, what is the best choice of tensor network for different classes of data? So maybe one-dimensional data with power law correlations should be treated with a MIRA, not an MPS, for instance. And then very interestingly as well is what is, again, I think, you know, one very cool thing about a tensor network would be that you can pick the weights apart. So instead of just having the weights as a big cloud of numbers in some high-dimensional space, you can sort of see that they have pieces and parts and there's like components to these weights. And you could look at different elements of the tensor network and say, what job is that piece doing? And you could think that many of the tensor's job is simply to extract features. So similar to the stories people tell about deep neural networks, where maybe you have scale, you know, levels of these tensors, and then they're kind of extracting features and projecting out features that are not useful for learning. And then there's a higher scale or something where more features are being extracted and there's rotations happening. But one very exciting thing is this is all happening now in a linear space with linear operations. So maybe a lot more theory can be brought to bear on this stories about features rather than having to kind of look through a set of nonlinear, you know, wrapping things in nonlinear functions that makes it very hard to do theory about. And so I think that could be an interesting direction. All right, thanks for your time.
Miles, okay, so are there any questions?
Thank you. So I had a question about the, so people in machine learning use this convolutional neural nets, and they are supposed to be useful and save you computational time and parameters. Mm. So is there an equivalent idea using tensor networks?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it would be a pretty simple analogy, but I think that's a great idea. So that they've just seen empirically in machine learning, and there's a growing understanding that when you're processing data, that, you know, the philosophy of machine learning often is that you want to just take a very, very general set of hypotheses about the models and don't try to impose too many prior ideas. But it turns out it is useful to, say, take the few bottom layers of a neural network and constrain them a lot and say that each neuron is only allowed to see or to care about some local patch of features coming in, and then its job is to process those, say, and send information to the next level. And so definitely, I think one could imagine various tensor networks where you actually start out with more constraints on the tensors and how the connectivity of tensors. So you might imagine a tree or something where the only some of the tensors only talk to a few of the incoming X tensors, like the input tensors or something, and you have local constraints. So I think that would be a very useful thing to pursue, because we already know it works in machine learning.
I'm just wondering if in this case it works because of this data set has some locality already, and so you get the tensor network to work because you have a locality built into your ansatz?
Yeah, so the question is about locality. So this is something, right, in physics, you usually need for this MPS approximation to be successful, to be coming that there's some local Hamiltonian for which this is a low-energy state, low-energy eigenstate. So I think it's like a yes, no, yes kind of answer. So pessimistically, I think maybe that maybe I got away with having a small bond dimension because the task was kind of easy or something. Like maybe that it's supervised, so I'm not trying to represent every possible question you could ask about the data, only a limited set of questions. That maybe allowed the entanglement to be small, the bond dimension to be small. That's a sort of a pessimistic way I could look at it. You know, optimistically too, there maybe it was smart enough to optimize the tensors to solve just that problem. But I think my best guess at what's happening here is that I simply did use the wrong ansatz for this 2D data, but that just as MPS can be very successful for 2D Hamiltonians as long as they're limited in size. You know, I shrunk the images down a bit, 14 by 14, and I also used a kind of very blurry local feature map, so there wasn't like. Okay, one thing you can say is that you can show if you keep choosing these capital phi vectors to be more and more and more and more orthogonal for any tiny variation in the input x, then you can show that the optimal classifier, the optimal w's, are simply just a sum of these orthogonal phis for every single phi in the class. You can easily show that. And so then that, you could imagine the entanglement could get really, really big because you're basically taking this huge space, this exponential space, and then you're taking a set of 100 or a few thousand kind of randomly chosen, totally orthogonal vectors and adding them up with like equal weights. And that could be very hard to compress into a tensor network. So I think part of it is that I chose these so that the images became very blurry under this local map, and so that all the sevens kind of map to sort of one primary direction in Hilbert space, and then all the eights map to some other direction. So then mainly the W just has to sort of get that main direction and then a few corrections to it in that cloud of where all the sevens cluster or something. So I think that's probably going on as well. Mm-hmm.
So maybe a possible extension to this work, let's say I give you, hopefully you know about quantum error correction codes. Let's say I give you a certain logical and a certain representation of that logical with respect to a certain stabilizer code. Like I gave you a bunch of polys, and if you apply your algorithm to try to understand this encoding map, I guess your tensor network would be a representation of the isometric encoding into a bunch of physical qubits. And then if I give you a different coset representative for a certain logical, and then you run it through that tensor network, then you get the logical operator that represents that certain coset representative for the logical operator. So basically what I'm saying is that you would kind of figure out what code, and with what code I encoded my information. And like, that's my intuition.
So I don't use much of that language, so it's a little hard for me to follow.
Okay.
But do you mean something about like maybe you could encode data redundantly into a network, and so then if there were some errors in the weights, that you could still extract the data? Is that the question? The idea?
Well, the quantum error correction formalism is just to work with certain quantum codes. How do you encode quantum information into more degrees of freedom, like non-locally, and then that gives you a tool for that. Mm-hmm. And I guess the tensor network is a way to characterize how, like, physically how you encode information.
That's right, how the information is stored.
Yeah.
So, I mean, actually, that was a motivation for this idea. I mean, I thought, I wanted to try this, and then I thought, maybe this is too crazy, and I knew that physicists being skeptical, and rightly so, would say that data, real-world data, should be very highly entangled if you think of it as like a sum in this high-dimensional space. And, you know, I shared that skepticism, but then I thought about a simple example, which would be, let's say you want to just identify patterns of closed loops. Then we know that there's like this toric code wave function, which is exactly a bond dimension 2 peps. And maybe that thing, if you made little frozen loop wave functions and then overlapped it with this thing and you got an overlap of 1, you would actually detect it has a loop or something. This is a cartoon, but I thought, okay, maybe some very complicated non-local patterns could be imposed by some local constraints or something.
Right.
It was just a motivation. But then So I think maybe one can see how these weights are solving a certain problem by diving into some tensor network decomposition of them.
There are no more questions. Thanks, Miles, for the talk.